I'm Ruthie, and I have a recorder. Tune in Wednesdays from 4 to 5 to Out There. We'll meet people and plants around the streets and paths of Northampton, and we'll think about ways we can share the world. Here on Valley Free Radio, or archived online at weatherbeer.com/out there. Get out if you can, but if you can't get out, tune in. We don't care if they laugh at us. Let them take the bus and need a sickle for us. They can have a Cadillac and T-1-2, but give me my rocket bicycle for two. And yes, it is Wednesday. Today is... What is today?
March 29th.
All right. I was trying to find... Okay, March 29th. And if you'll notice, that was not my voice. That was my deep in thought voice. Dwayne Rainey, thanks for coming into the studio today. Can you hear me? It's just my headphones. I can't hear myself.
Yeah, turn them up.
All right.
Turn them up.
What's your shirt say, Dwayne?
Lost in Thought. Please send search party.
All right.
And you're lost in thought today.
Yeah, so thanks for coming up. Today's show on Out There is the main thing I have is so last week I talked about three people from Migrant Justice in Burlington, Vermont that had been arrested, detained by ICE. And so they had a bond hearing in Boston on Monday that I went to with a handful of other people. We met at the Pioneer Valley Workers Center. So I have some recordings about that and an interview with someone named Austin, who I rode in the car with, who's a student from Middlebury College up in Vermont and is involved with Migrant Justice. And then, well, at the march... Or rally, it wasn't really, well, yeah, at the gathering. It was a gathering of support for the three people that had been locked up. I made a sign that said, Fugitive Slave Act of 2017? Which side of history are you on? So I've just been thinking about that a lot. And so I did a bunch of research today about the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. And I'm going to read a bunch off of Wikipedia for that, and also share some of my own thoughts, comparisons, and then I don't know what Dwayne's gonna have up his sleeve. Wait,
I have no sleeves.
You got a sleeveless shirt on. What do you think? It's summertime.
At least nobody can see me.
All right, I think I'm just going to start with Dwayne.
What about the wind?
There wasn't any wind when I was working earlier, and then when I was biking, or like noon, it like came. I don't know where it came from. Came out of somewhere.
The only thing is all the energy I expelled pedaling up here. I'm just gonna have a smooth ride on the way back.
All right.
Wear out my brakes.
All right. This is Austin. Do you mind starting all over again?
It's all good. Yeah.
Okay. So. We're in the car going to Boston to a bond hearing for three migrant justice workers?
Organizers
from Burlington, Vermont. Austin, can you tell me how you got involved with migrant justice and where you're from?
Yeah, my name is Austin Kahn. I'm a student at Middlebury College in central Vermont. I first got involved with migrant justice when I was a freshman at Middlebury. Started working with like the student farm worker solidarity group called Juntos on campus, and then slowly became more and more involved in migrant justice's more political activity in relation to like improving the state of the dairy industry and building farm worker power.
Can you say a thing about Juntos? Is that what it was? What were you doing with them, or what did they do?
Yeah, Juntos, Farm Worker Student Solidarity Group, is a student organization that started mostly doing like English as a second language tutoring, and then also kind of like solidarity, like support work for migrant justice, really just kind of like responding to the needs of migrant justice and like bringing them to campus to like talk to student groups and like hosting events on campus, and we would facilitate or like really just open a space for the Addison County like worker asambleas, which are just like regional meetings that happen every so often for farm workers to like meet up and get organized.
So how did Migrant Justice start? Was there anything that prompted it to be organized?
Yeah, Migrant Justice started about, I believe it was like 7 or maybe 8 years ago, in response to the death of a farm worker who was strangled to death by a some sort of machinery on one of the dairy farm where he worked. There was very little kind of accountability, and it was kind of hushed up pretty quickly. And there was kind of a big effort to bring his body back to Chiapas, Mexico, to his family. That had obviously heard about the effort through this kind of like solidarity network of people who had been supporting like farm workers and farm workers who had begun organizing themselves. And so from there, that was kind of like a boiling point in some ways of like kind of this realization that like there needs to be some sort of organizing body to demand dignity and respect for farm workers in the state's dairy industry.
What are some of the campaigns that Migrant Justice has been working on?
Some of their successful campaigns that have happened in the past include one that we were talking about earlier is driver's licenses, so achieving the right for non-citizens to gain access to legal driver's like documentation. Mobility is a really big issue on dairy farms. Farm workers are really tend to be really isolated and really dependent on their employers for like, you know, access to a grocery store or to the free medical clinic and other things like that. And so it was a really big step to get farm workers the ability to drive legally.
What about Milk with Dignity campaign?
Yeah, Milk with Dignity is a really dope campaign that was modeled after the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, which is a similar kind of worker-led organization in Florida that basically tries to create accountability within the industry. So as opposed to appealing or trying to leverage like the suppliers, it goes directly to the purchasers. So like these big companies that would source New England dairy products like Ben & Jerry's, Cabot Cheese, and other such companies would be held accountable because they're sourcing from these farms that in a large sort of way are violating the human rights of their farm workers, and so kind of putting pressure on those companies to account for the human rights violations that exist in their supply chain.
So the three Migrant Justice organizers that were just arrested a couple of weeks ago, what do you know about them? Can you say their names?
Yeah, so Alex Carrillo is a member of the Migrant Justice's Farm Worker Coordinating Committee, which is a body of farm worker organizers who are in contact with kind of a network of farm workers across the state and organize around the Milk with Dignity campaign and Know Your Rights or efforts to bring education to farms in terms of Know Your Rights and the events of ICE raids and other such activities. Yeah, Alex is not the first of the farm worker organizing committee that has been detained. There were two previous detentions of active members of that organizing body. Miguel Alculio was arrested back in the fall, and then Victor Diaz was arrested last spring. I believe it was late April, maybe early May. Yeah, Alex is the father of, I believe, a four-year-old. He has a wife living in Vermont who's a U.S. citizen. And he was actually detained in her presence, which I'm sure was tragic for the family. And then Quique Balcázar and Sully Palacios are both organizers with Migrant Justice. Quique has been involved with the Farm Worker Coordinating Committee since, I believe it was like 2013, 2012 maybe. He's been in the state of Vermont since he was 17, and he came to join his father, who had already been working on a dairy farm, and immediately became aware of the kind of dehumanizing circumstances that existed on Vermont dairy farms. So he quickly became involved with Migrant Justice and began organizing with them, and then he became a full-time staff member within the last few years. And then Sully Palacios is from Peru, and she became involved with Migrant Justice about a year ago, started working on the Milk with Dignity campaign, and then also began organizing with Marita Canedo, who's another organizer with Migrant Justice, this women's farm worker kind of organization that aims to tackle the specific issues that, that women on dairy farms face. Both in, all three of them are really incredible people and do really important work in the state. And it's pretty clear that this is an action of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, like a pretty clear act of repression in retaliation of for the political activity that all three have been engaged in over the last several years.
So the other two migrant justice workers that you were organizers that you mentioned, what happened after they were arrested by ICE?
Yeah, fortunately, Migrant Justice was able to galvanize a lot of public support, reached out to their allies and their kind of support networks and got people and the other organizations across the country that they've connected to, and were able to make a pretty loud and compelling appeal to the immigration judge. There were like a series of rallies held in Burlington and Montpelier and these kind of like social media campaigns to demand their release. And eventually that's what happened after a few painful weeks of detention. Miguel was released back in, I want to say, October of 2016, and then Victor, when he was detained back in the spring of 2016, he was also released in response to those campaigns of demonstrating public support for their release.
When ICE arrests someone and then they are released by the immigration judge, like, is it like, does ICE have to feel like they have to save face, or how does that work legally, or can you say anything about that?
Yeah, I'm not sure that I could speak too much to the legality and like how ICE necessarily responds when they have to kind of go back on their like supposed commitment to like public safety or whatever kind of justification they use to detain farm worker organizers. But in the past, it's kind of they're just responding to this call that like these are really important members of our communities and they don't like satisfy whatever ICE's like priorities are for detaining people, like depending on like how much of like a public safety risk or whatever they supposedly are. But yeah, I don't know if I could speak too much more to that.
So for today's a bond hearing. Alex, Suli, and Kike, what do you think will happen today?
I have a feeling that there's going to be enough of a demonstration of support and all the other evidence that that's been, I know Migrant Justice has collected upwards of like 150 letters of support demanding the release of all three Migrant Justice activists. So I imagine the immigration judge will respond to that accordingly and hopefully exercises their prosecutional discretion and allow all three activists to remain in the state of Vermont to be freed.
What about other farm workers that are being arrested by ICE who aren't so high profile? I assume that's happening too in Vermont. What's going on? How does Migrant Justice respond to that, or what are some of the challenges around that?
Yeah, Migrant Justice finds itself in a pretty, from what I've observed, like a pretty tricky position, responding to the detentions of farm workers who maybe haven't been as like politically active or haven't been as engaged with their activities specifically. In a lot of ways, it's kind of the farm worker organizers' like active involvement and like kind of interface like with the wider Vermont community. Like, unfortunately, a really like tragic reality for a lot of farm workers is like just isolation. People can find it very hard to get off of the dairy farms. Maybe, you know, once a week they'll go and get groceries if they're not paying someone to go get them for them. So it's just hard. It's a lot harder to galvanize support, like public support, for those people who are forced by the systems in place to like be invisible and to like, you know, whose work we're so easy right? For whose work is so easily overlooked, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. I'm your host, Ruthie. I'll just say Ruthie because I was going to introduce that last speaker and I forgot his last name and only know his name is Austin. And he's from Middlebury College in Vermont. So I won't say my last name either. So this, the interview that you just heard, that was done in the car on Monday. We were going to Boston to the bond hearing for three organizers of migrant justice out of Burlington, Vermont, who were arrested by ICE a couple of weeks ago. I have some more from that next. Okay, I got another couple minutes on that.
Do you mind starting all over again?
Oh, nope, that's not the right one.
Okay, so...
Let me stop that one. Oh, Dwayne, unfortunately, Dwayne is here.
Radio, so you're allowed to make mistakes.
Yeah, I am definitely alive right now. I'm alive.
No, allowed.
Oh.
Allowed to make a mistake. So...
Yeah, because you got an announcement coming up there, Dwayne. Announce away.
I don't have the date. See the end. I think it's April 29th at Grow Food Northampton office over here on 221 Pine Street in Northampton.
Florence?
At Florence.
Same thing.
Pine Street in Florence, yes.
Arts and Industry Building.
Right across
building.
From this studio, in their studio, their brand new, huge, big studio that they have for
Not right across. That's down the hill. We know hills when we go up and down hills.
Yeah, whatever.
Tell us.
But it's not directly across the street. It's diagonally across the street.
So what is it?
Yeah, it's just how seeds are disappearing. I mean, you got Monsanto, and that's...
What'd you say, movie?
It's a movie.
Okay, I missed that.
The untold story of seeds. Because major corporations are making, you know, hybrid seeds and everything. So, got to save the seed. And I think it's on April 29th. I just looked on my phone and I erased the email. Sorry about that, Pat.
Oh, I'm pretty sure it's April 5th.
April 5th?
Yeah, April 5th. That's when I wrote it on my calendar.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, you can find it on the Grow Food.
It's the 5th or
website.
The 29th. So you can go on the 5th, but it's not on the 5th. Well, more will be revealed on Friday's show.
Okay. So, all right. I'm going to continue this about the bond hearing in Boston for the migrant justice workers. So we got there, a group of us that came from Western Mass, and there were probably, I don't know, 100, 200 people that were gathering to support the three people having the hearing. And interestingly enough, according to the Burlington Free Press, the three people whose hearing it was were locked up in detention centers. Like, I think one in Dover, New Hampshire, and I'm not sure. Maybe they were all three there. I think they may have been in different places, but they were like telecommuted or something.
Teleported?
Teleconferenced or something.
Oh, so they weren't even there.
But the judge was there, and that was why we were there, because that's where the immigration judge is. And so we were there to deliver. They had this giant sheet of signatures, people who had signed the petition for them to be released, but it was pouring rain. It was like 45 degrees and pouring rain all day, so that giant sheet of signatures ended up being a big puddle.
A lot of puddle ink.
But anyway, we were joyous and we were loud and we had something to say, and here's some more of that.
Here, outside the courthouse here in Boston, where Enrique Balcazar, Zuli Palacios, and Alexis Carrillo will have a court case to see if we can get their bonds lowered that have been set extremely high. $14,000 bond for Enrique, $21,000 for Alexis, and no bond for Zuli.
We have an assembly to plan to launch our campaign for a one-day strike for Días Sin Inmigrantes on May Day. And 3 weeks later, we found out that our friends had been kidnapped by ICE from our community. So let us be clear that what is happening today, what is happening in Vermont, what happened in Burlington, is political retribution because of the organizing and empowering work that organizers are doing. And it's not just happening in Burlington, it's happening across the country. This is the new tactics of intimidation that we're seeing under the current administration.
So those are some of the clips from Monday's thing at rally in Boston. According to the Burlington Free Press article, the judge reduced the bail for two of the people, for Kike and Suli. He reduced the bail to $2,500 apiece, and Migrant Justice was able to bail them out, so they are now out. But he denied bail for Alex. I think... because so Alex was actually arrested by ICE when he was on his way to the courthouse for a hearing. He had been charged with DUI at some earlier point. And according to the Migrant Justice press release, he had gotten off work at 4 a.m. and he was driving home and fell asleep at the wheel and was subsequently charged with DUI. And he was on his way to a hearing a few weeks ago when he got arrested by ICE, and then he didn't make it to the hearing, but his DUI charges were dismissed. But I think that because, you know, he was suspected of something, and I guess that fits into Donald Trump's categories of being suspected of something, and that being a good enough reason to
very bad hombre
arrest someone. So what else? What else? Oh, you know, you heard in one of those talks the guy talking about the May Day strike. So I want to give a shout out to that. Cosecha, I think, is one of the main organizers of that. It's a national strike for a day without immigrants, Un Día Sin Inmigrantes, to call attention to the economic impact that undocumented people have in this country. There's around 12 million undocumented people here. And I know a lot of times people trying to make political change, and it just seems very elusive, or, you know, can't be trusted. So undocumented immigrants are taking this into their own hands and using the power they have to show their economic power.
Well, don't look for any food in the north end of Boston that night. I used to do deliveries from a small produce warehouse and to all these Italian restaurants in the North End. And you know what? I didn't see too many Italians down there in the kitchens.
Yeah. All right. I'm going to play a little song here and then talk about the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. I'm Ruthie, and this is Dwayne Rainey here. This is Lilo Gonzalez. Ningún ser humano es ilegal.
Semana Santa, abril del 82, aún llevo el olor a incienso a mi pueblo y su dolor. Aún llevo el olor a incienso a mi pueblo y su dolor. De prisa, sin un adiós, sin plata o un pantalón, pensando volver muy pronto a mi pueblo El Salvador. Pensando volver muy pronto a mi pueblo El Salvador. Ay, qué bonita es mi tierra, te lo digo, compañero. Ay, qué bonita es mi tierra, que lo sepa el mundo entero. Ay, qué bonita es mi tierra, te lo digo, compañero. Ay, qué bonita es mi tierra, que lo sepa el mundo entero. Vivir aquí, no puedo vivir allá. Señores, ¿cuándo tendremos un poquitito de paz? Señores, ¿cuándo tendremos un poquitito de paz? Hoy vivo aquí en La Mampleza, frente a un palo de coyol. Para no morirme soñando, cantemos esta canción. Para no morirme soñando, cantemos esta canción. No que un mambini silido, te lo digo, compañero. No que un mambini silido, que lo sepa el mundo entero. No que un mambini silido, te lo digo, compañero. No que un mambini silido, que lo sepa el mundo entero.
Thanks for that message, Lilo Gonzalez. And so next, Dwayne, talk about some of the other shows here on Valley Free Radio, WXOJ 103.3 LP FM in Northampton.
In Florence, Northampton,
coming to you from the basement of the Florence.
Coming out to this show is Democracy Now,
yes.
Which...
Wait.
What?
Coming to you from the basement of the Florence Community Center, which is where Dwayne went to grammar school.
Yes, I did.
All right, Democracy Now.
First grade, happy year. It's not that they couldn't just take me for a happy year. It's just they opened a new school up on Ryan Road. So up after this show, out there is Democracy Now. I watch that at night on TV, like around 7 o'clock, I think.
Uh-huh.
And also, we have Bread and Roses. That's on Friday after my show at 4 o'clock.
What's your show?
My show?
Yeah, tell us about your show.
Oh, My Generation. From 2 to 4 every Friday here on WXOJ 103.3 FM in Northampton. There's some music from the 70s. So anything in the 70s, I'm going to be playing it sooner or later.
And it's not just the hits that some people know. It's because you listen to the whole albums, right?
Well,
that's how you know the good songs.
That's how we used to take and do it back in the day. You get an album. I mean, I had a whole mess of albums. And the app that I use, Spotify, let's just say that, If I type in an artist, it pops up pretty much everything that person has ever done. Most of the time, except for some people like Bob Seger, or just most of the artists that put out any kind of music, I can take and pull up. So I have a great library. I do all sorts of music. I do some of the hits. I try and stay away from disco. Really.
But you take call-in requests. What if someone calls in and requests disco?
Oh, you mean like...
Would you play it for me?
That's just an ABBA song. I mean, or Linda Ronstadt or something. Yeah, okay. I do requests. I can pull it up. I can get anything on. Let's see, last week was somebody had a birthday. And they called me up and said, oh, can you please play Birthday by the Beatles? Bingo. I got it on.
All right. Yeah. So if you're tired of all this talk, 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 tune in to My Generation Fridays from 2 to 4.
Music.
Ms. Dwayne will be spinning tunes.
Spinning tunes.
Just clicking tunes.
Also, right. Let's see. We have out there. And Occupy the Airwaves. Local and national activism on Sunday at 10 a.m. And that will do it for the PSAs for this hour.
thanks, Dwayne. So thinking about people who are arrested by ICE, it's like, what crimes have they really committed? Who defined those crimes, arbitrary kind of crimes? Well, it made me think about the Fugitive Slave Act ones, particularly the one in 1850. I guess I first started thinking about or learning about that one or researching a little bit more because just outside the studio here in Florence on the corner of Park and Pine Street is the Sojourner Truth statue and little park. And in that park, there are three historical plaques that tell a little bit about the history of Florence. Sojourner Truth used to live here. There's a house on Park Street where she lived. And the Northampton Association of Education and Industry was a utopian community that believed in equality for men, women, black, white. And actually, Saturday, April 8th, is 175th anniversary of the Northampton Association of Education and Industry in the David Ruggles Society, David Ruggles Museum on Nonotuck Street. They sponsor that, and you can find out more information about that there. But anyway, so when you look at the park and you look at the information about Florence as being this hub for people who had escaped slavery and having a substantial black population community, then there's a question like, well, then what happened? This is like in the 1840s, and what happened was the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. Or that was one major thing that happened. So this is... I'm going to be reading a bunch from Wikipedia. say it, Dwayne.
Wikipedia? just don't look it up, Ruthie.
Look, you play music off of Spotify, so I'm going to read off of Wikipedia.
I mean, that is a great search engine. It's also nonprofit, and they have fund drives for that also.
Okay, so the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. It was passed by the United States Congress in 1850 as part of the Compromise of 1850 between Southern slaveholding interests and Northern freesoilers. The act was one of the most controversial elements of the 1850 Compromise, and it heightened Northern fears of what they called a slave power conspiracy. It required that all escaped slaves were, upon capture, to be returned to their masters, and that officials and citizens of free states had to cooperate in this law. Abolitionists nicknamed it the Bloodhound Law for the dogs that were used to track down runaway slaves. So to go back a few years, in 1843, several hundred slaves a year were successfully escaping to the north, making slavery an unstable institution in the border states. The earlier Fugitive Slave Act of 1793 was a federal law which was written with the intent to enforce Article 4, Section 2 of the United States Constitution. Oh, I'm going to talk about that in just a minute, which required the return of runaway slaves. It sought to force the authorities in free states to return fugitive slaves to their masters. Okay, so Article 4, Section 2 of the U.S. Constitution, what is that? The Constitution, it was like signed in 1776, right? Something like that.
Yes.
That's why we got this quarters, the centennial quarters. It helps us remember when these things happen.
No.
I remember 1776. Well, okay. You I remember the quarters.
You look a lot younger.
That's a centennial meant bicentennial. Okay. So, Article 4, Section 2 of the United States Constitution. So, these two guys from South Carolina, Pierce Butler and Charles Pinckney, they submitted this clause to the Constitutional Convention. And James Wilson of Pennsylvania objected, stating that it would require that state governments enforce slavery at taxpayers' expense. That sounds familiar. Let's build a wall. Okay.
We don't need a wall.
So Butler, one of the sponsors of the clause, he withdrew it. However, on the next day, the clause was quietly reinstated and adopted by the convention without objection. This clause was added to the clause that provided extradition for fugitives from justice. So when first adopted, this clause, Article 4, Section 2, it applied to fugitive slaves and required that they be extradited upon the claims of their masters, but it provided no means for doing so. The Fugitive Slave Act of 1793 created the mechanism for recovering a fugitive slave, overruled any state laws giving sanctuary, and made it a federal crime to assist an escaped slave, and allowed slave catchers into every U.S. state and territory. As free states sought to undermine the federal law, the even more severe Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 was enacted. Yeah. Ice is everywhere. Okay. In 1864...
Even before they were ice.
Yeah. In 1864, during the Civil War, an effort to repeal this clause of the Constitution failed. This clause was rendered mostly moot when the 13th Amendment abolished slavery. Well, I say mostly moot, because you could watch the movie 13th to see the slavery still exists. But all right, so that's a little bit about that. Now, there's more. Believe me, there's a lot more.
Just Google it.
No, I think it's really interesting, so I'm going up.
Okay.
So many northern states wanted to circumvent the Fugitive Slave Act. Some jurisdictions passed personal liberty laws mandating a jury trial before alleged fugitive slaves could be moved. Others forbade the use of local jails or the assistance of state officials in the arrest or return of alleged fugitive slaves. Which leads me, some states forbade the use of local jails. Okay, so that reminds me, I have this little article from the Greenfield Recorder, just a couple paragraphs, from February 23, 2017. For years, the Franklin County Jail on Elm Street has regularly housed about 75 immigrants who are said to have entered the United States illegally. All were brought in from around the country through an ICE Immigration and Customs Enforcement contract. The money paid by the federal government has supplemented the state money for operation of the Elm Street Jail and House of Correction. Most recently, ICE has paid about $3 million to the state for using the Greenfield Jail.
Which is a pit.
Have you been there?
It was a pit.
It was,
they
yeah.
got a new one now, but they get money for federal prisoners. So it's all integrated, whether you're waiting trial or you're sentenced. It's all just everyone's together.
Yeah, I'm sure it's hard to say no to $3 million for a county jail. You know, ICE has paid about $3 million to the state for using the Greenfield Jail, about $1 million of which goes toward the jail budget. Wait, what did the other $2 million go to? I don't know. Anyway. These ICE detainees are usually being held pending deportation following a final judge's order. They typically leave the country via the international airports in Boston, Hartford, and New York. Sheriff Christopher Donnellan said his officers are not trained to be ICE agents, nor does he or his staff plan on training them to be ones. In Massachusetts, there are three locations that have arrangements with ICE for holding their prisoners, one through the Department of Correction in Franklin County, and the others with two sheriff's offices, one in Bristol and the other in Plymouth. Okay, so that's a little local thing about jails being used as detention centers for captured fugitives. All right. So back to the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. Oh, yeah. You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. And I'm Ruthie. And Dwayne's in here, too. Thanks for listening. So in some cases, under the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, juries refused to convict individuals who had been indicted under the federal law. The Missouri Supreme Court routinely held with the laws of neighboring free states in that slaves who had been voluntarily transported by their owners into free states with the intent of the masters residing there permanently or indefinitely gained their freedom as a result. The Fugitive Slave Law dealt with slaves who escaped to free states without their master's consent. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Prigg v. Pennsylvania in 1842 that states did not have to offer aid in the hunting or recapture of slaves, greatly weakening the law of 1793. So this is before the 1850 Act, but after the 1793 Fugitive Slave Act. So after 1840, here's a little story about Cass County, Michigan. After 1840, the black population of rural Cass County, Michigan grew rapidly as families were attracted by white defiance of discriminatory laws, by numerous highly supportive Quakers, and by low-priced land. Free and runaway blacks found Cass County a haven. Their good fortune attracted the attention of Southern slaveholders. In 1847 and 1849, planters from Bourbon and Boone counties in northern Kentucky led raids into Cass County to recapture runaway slaves. The raids failed, but the situation contributed to Southern demands in 1850 for passage of the strengthened Fugitive Slave Act. All right. I guess I want to say a couple more things about the thing about Cass County. Kind of reminded me what I said about Florence a little bit as a similar place for people who had escaped slavery. So the Northampton Association of Education and Industry from the 1840s, 50s, the celebration, 175th anniversary celebration that's coming up on Saturday, April 8th. Some of the things that will be happening is there'll be a walking tour from 10 to noon. At 1 o'clock the walking tour, I think, starts at the David Ruggles Center. And at 1 o'clock at the Elks Lodge on Spring Street in Florence, there's a presentation by Christopher Clark, who's a local author, historian, about living deliberately, abolition and community at Northampton in the 1840s. And also Steve Strymer is talking at the Elks Lodge, and also in a panel about the meaning of the Northampton Association. So there are events coming up on Saturday, April 8th, here in Florence. All right, I got more to say about the Fugitive Slave Act.
I bet you do.
Yes, I do. Okay. So in response to the weakening of the original Fugitive Slave Act, like the 1793 one, I guess, the Fugitive Slave Law of 1850 penalized officials who did not arrest an alleged runaway slave and made them liable to a fine of $1,000, which in today's money, that would be like $29,000. Law enforcement everywhere were required to arrest people suspected of being a runaway slave on as little as a claimant's sworn testimony of ownership. Who's got the power here? In addition, the suspected slave could not ask for a jury trial or testify on his or own or his of his could not testify on his or her own behalf. In addition, any person aiding a runaway slave any person aiding a runaway slave by providing food or shelter was subject to 6 months imprisonment and the $1,000 fine. Officers who captured a fugitive slave were entitled to a bonus or promotion for their work. Slave owners needed only to supply an affidavit to a federal marshal to capture an escaped slave. Since a suspected slave was not eligible for a trial, the law resulted in the kidnapping and conscription of free blacks into slavery, as suspected fugitive slaves had no rights in court and could not defend themselves against accusations. Wow. All right. So you might ask, how long did this go on? No, I already answered that question. So some of the ways that people tried to fight this. So in 1855, 5 years after the 1850 Act, the Wisconsin Supreme Court became the only state high court to declare the Fugitive Slave Act unconstitutional as a result of a case involving fugitive slave Joshua Glover and Sherman Booth, who led efforts that thwarted Glover's recapture. But in, however, in 1859, like 4 years later, the U.S. Supreme Court overruled the Wisconsin State Court. Okay, so now he's talking about Vermont. So there's actually some Vermont history here. In November of 1850, the Vermont legislature passed the habeas corpus law, requiring Vermont judicial and law enforcement officials to assist captured fugitive slaves. Okay. It required Vermont judicial and law enforcement officials to assist captured fugitive slaves. It also established a state judicial process parallel to the federal process for people accused of being fugitive slaves. Dwayne, are you falling asleep?
No, I'm not. Not yet.
Okay, not yet. Okay.
I'm preparing to read my next bit of stuff after you're done.
Yeah, you're so polite. Okay. Well, I'll skip to some more exciting parts. So there's a thing called jury nullification. That was when Northern juries acquitted men accused of violating the law. Secretary of State Daniel Webster was a key supporter of the law of the Fugitive Slave Act. He wanted high profile convictions. He wanted anyone that was helping slaves or people who had been enslaved, anyone who was helping them keep their freedom, he wanted them guilty. And that's partly because he was planning on running for president in 1852, and he wanted the support of the South. And Webster led the prosecution against men accused of rescuing Shadrach Minkins in 1851 from Boston officials who intended to return Minkins to his owner when the juries convicted none of the men. You ever heard of Shadrach Minkins, Dwayne? I never had. Can I tell you about this guy or about his
case?
Please
do.
Oh, I will. All right. So he was born in 1814, died 1875. He was an enslaved African-American born in Virginia who escaped in 1850 and reached Boston.
You should play that number. 1850, because you said it like so many times.
Okay. So he's known for being freed from a courtroom in Boston after being captured by United States Marshals under the Fugitive Slave Act.
Of what year?
All right. So the U.S. Marshals that captured him at his job at a coffee house in Boston, white and black members of the Boston Vigilance Committee, freed and hid him. They took him from the marshals by force out of the courthouse. I want to know how they did that.
Probably with a gun.
Yeah. And
or two.
Yeah, and they helped him get to Canada via the Underground Railroad. Minkins settled in Montreal, where he raised a family. Two men were prosecuted in Boston for helping free him, but they were acquitted by the jury. Shadrach Minkins. Wow. Okay. So, I just thought it was interesting, like, some of the ways that people tried to fight this federal law that states didn't necessarily agree with, and these crazy edicts coming down from the feds.
They're hiring 6,000 more people for ICE.
Yeah, and it's costing a lot of money. Do you see how many billions of dollars in the budget are key marked for this?
And ICE can go from like 100 miles in from any place of entry into the United States.
What?
Yeah. Whether it's Mexico, all of California, all of the East Coast, all of any coast and in for 100 miles. So that means from Boston is like 100 miles from Northampton.
Wait, they can. What do you mean they can go 100 miles in?
They can chase people like.
Across into Canada, into Mexico?
No.
What do you mean?
People coming in.
Uh-huh.
ICE has jurisdiction for like 100 miles in from any point of entry into the United States.
Well, I thought they could go anywhere they wanted in the United States. Anyway.
That's why they're putting more agents.
Oh, I see what you mean. But, you know, when I've taken the bus or the train sometimes, but in Rochester, I think it is. Rochester?
Right.
They, ICE agents, very often they get on the bus on the Peter Pan or the Greyhound. They get on the bus and they go seat to seat saying, are you a U.S. citizen? Are you a U.S. citizen? And asking to see people's IDs. When they come to me, I'm like.
No hablo inglesio.
Yeah, I refuse. I don't consent. I don't cooperate. because it really sucks, because I've seen people take, you know, they take people off the bus just because they don't have IDs. And they're people of color, and they have a non-Southern or non-Yankee accent.
I must have looked like I belong here because they didn't ask me nothing. Maybe because of the way I looked at them. Like, you're going to ask me something?
Yeah. All right. Well, just to wrap it up.
Hey, before you wrap it up.
Wait, no, I got to wrap up what I'm saying here.
I thought you did.
So some opponents of the act, such as African-American leader Harriet Tubman, simply treated the law as just another complication in their activities. And one important consequence was that Canada became a major destination for escaped slaves. The black population of Canada increased from 40,000 to 60,000 between 1850 and 1860. So here's my commentary. Similarities and differences today with people who escaped slavery and people who have fled countries where the situations are very often very difficult, often because of U.S. policies. It's like, what was their crime? People say, oh, it's illegal to be here, but what was their real crime? What constitutes a fugitive from justice? Like, are there some so-called crimes that people should be arrested and sent to jail for? Usually if someone commits a crime, they go to jail. Are there other crimes that people don't get punished for, just kicked out? Anyway, so I talked with a dairy farm worker at the rally in Boston on Monday who's connected with Migrant Justice. He didn't want to talk on the radio. It's a dangerous time. But I asked him if he had any message for listeners, and he said, I just don't understand why people don't like us or treat us any different. We come here, we work hard, we're just trying for a better life, but we're singled out in the grocery store, wherever. But we're just like everyone else, working to feed their families. And, okay, arbitrary laws around borders and immigration? No, not arbitrary. They're racist, classist, white supremacist, and capitalist. Okay, time for a break. What are you going to say, Dwayne? I got a song, too, before the end of the show, but you got another announcement to make.
The Florence Community Band 16th Anniversary Spring Concert, Sunday, April 9th, 2015, 2 p.m. at Northampton High School. Free admission with a donation of a non-perishable food item for the Northampton Survival Center. So you got any old cans of beans kicking around? You're in luck.
Well, you mean old for you, but not like out of date. Do they take out of date stuff? They probably don't take out of date stuff.
No, but I mean,
you can give that to me.
It seems like, yeah, everyone's got like that one can of something in. On their shelf in one of their cabinets that they're never going to use. I mean, one thing I noticed that they don't can is like Brussels sprouts.
Oh.
Ugh.
But they can spinach.
Yeah, well,
it's kind of, well, true.
Different. But yeah, hey, bring a couple cans.
All right.
Bring the whole family.
All right.
Clean out your cupboards.
It's
going to a good cause.
All right. So I'm going to play. This is Climbing Poetry. Thanks for listening to Out There Today, if you're still listening. I enjoyed the show. It's really informative for me. So thanks for the motivation for me to educate myself. Democracy Now! Is coming on at 5 o'clock. You can listen to archived editions of Out There at weatherbeard.com/out there.
You going to play a song?
Yep, going to play a song.
Going to play a song?
Going to play a song.
What kind of song?
What's the name of the song? Climbing Poetry, We Survived.
Around our stars, 50 years to life behind their bars. We survived middle school and self-inflicted scars, losing.
made our mothers to our father's hands. We survived slavery and genocide, came back from the dead and spread like wildfire. The droughts and the prisons, Jim Crow and gas chambers, for warfare and lynching. The seeds from our strange fruit been sprinkled across this terrain by our angels.
And everywhere we land, we're gonna take root.
And every inch of rock, mud, and sand,
we're gonna break through.
You're here right now. I'm seeing you with my own two eyes. Think of all the demons tried to take you, and you still survived,
and we will survive.
Summon the strength of all those who came before us, and all those coming. We must be free.